Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Greetings, folks, and welcome to Extra Time. I'm your host, Matt Doyle, coming to you from a hot and sweaty New York City here in the depths of summer. Coming up on this show, we're going to take a look at the first two rounds of the group stage of the League's Cup. The game has been coming fast and furious, so our good friend Andrew Wiebe is taking a well-deserved day off. You can catch him and the rest of the gang every night on both Countdown and Wrap Up before and after all the games. And meanwhile, our top super sub, Kalen Carr, is flying out to Chicago, where he'll be on the mic for Club America's League's Cup Showcase tune-up versus Aston Villa. So that means once again that I am flying solo, but this time it's only for most of the show, not all of the show, as we're going to bring in MLS Season Pass's own Rodolfo Landeros. He's been covering soccer in North America for about 15 years, so the man can bring us some perspective, especially on the Liga MX Giants, who have struggled so far through these first two rounds of the group stage. Okay, let's set the stage overall. There are 19 teams, including Club America and Columbus, who had the bye. The two teams who had the bye into the round of 32, who are into the round of 32 already. I'm going to list those teams off. Austin FC, shockingly, topping their group despite having two of the biggest Mexican teams in that group. LAFC, Pachuca, Toronto FC, DC United, Philadelphia Union, SC Juarez, St. Louis City, Mazatlan, Tigres, Inter Miami, LA Galaxy, FC Cincinnati, NYCFC, Toluca, Sporting KC, Portland. Those are the teams that are into the round of 32 already, teams that have already been eliminated. It's fewer. It's just the Red Bulls, who lost on shootouts both times, FC Dallas, Puebla, Querétaro, and the Chicago Fire, already done for the League's Cup. So let's jump in to what we have seen so far. I'm just going to go group by group and talk about it sort of team by team. In East 1, Cincinnati right now are atop the group. They won their game against Querétaro. They had their new debut, had their debut from their new center back, Chidozie Awuzie-M, who I thought was pretty good. And then they also got some good attacking moments from guys not named Lucho Acosta. I don't think it was an entirely commanding performance, but it was kind of the positive bullet point that you're looking for from this team at this point as they try to get the pieces back together and become a fully functional team again ahead of the stretch run in league's play and the playoffs, and then obviously with the hope of winning this tournament as well. The second team in that group, NYCFC, they have yet to play against FC Cincinnati. They, of course, tied Querétaro over the weekend, a scoreless draw, still trying to find their way as they're missing a couple of pieces, as Nick Cushing is still sort of searching for his best 11 and what that looks like specifically in attack. Because I said it last week, since Malachi Jones went down, he hasn't fully trusted any of the other young wingers on the team. And that means he's sort of played around a little bit with Santi Rodriguez's position. And I don't think NYCFC are as good a team when Santi is not the number 10. So I'm looking forward this weekend to seeing NYCFC and Cincinnati play, because these are two of the better MLS teams who still actually have a lot of questions to answer for the rest of this season in terms of who they are, how they'll line up. I mean, we've seen it with Pat Noonan as well, like using Luca Orellano sometimes as an inverted right winger or right wing back, or sometimes using him as sort of a secondary number 10, you know, toggling between a 3-4-1-2 and a 3-4-2-1. Like, it's subtle differences, but they matter in terms of how well the team functions. So those two teams are through, though. We'll see them both in the round of 32. They got at least two more games in the League's Cup. Querétaro, meanwhile, as expected, are eliminated. in East 2. So far, nobody is officially into the round of 32. San Luis are bottom with 0 points. Montreal have played their two games. They beat San Luis. They lost badly to Orlando City, and Orlando City played that one game. They beat the breaks off of Montreal, winning 4-1. Right now, I mean, it looks like Orlando City are going to be massive favorites. San Luis have not looked good in their one game. They did not look good against Montreal, and Orlando City looked excellent. And they've continued to look excellent since since the personnel shift with Martin Ojeda playing as a number 10. They'll also probably get Duncan Maguire back, maybe not for this weekend, but for any subsequent games, because the U.S. were just eliminated in the quarterfinals of the Olympic tournament by a really good Morocco team. It's kind of a get your stock now situation for Orlando City. I think, you know, Kalen and I were talking about it last week on the show. Neither of us think this team can really win it, but a run to the quarterfinals or the semifinals wouldn't shock anybody. What would shock me is if they lost badly here and turned the standings upside down. Like, they could technically be eliminated, but they would have to lose something like 5-0. To San Luis for that to happen. I don't think that's going to happen. I'm pretty sure that Orlando and Montreal are going to get through. East 3, so this is the big one. Puebla have already been eliminated. They've lost to both Miami and Tigres. Miami and Tigres are two of the seven best teams in this tournament, at least on paper. I cannot wait to see. And, like, they'll be playing with very, very little on the line, because they're both already into the next round. But, like, this is the game of the weekend, Miami versus Tigres. We know what Tigres have done over the past dozen years, 15 years really, in Liga MX, becoming one of the three biggest clubs in terms of success. They have the most veteran lineup of any team in this tournament, and they're facing the Miami team that is still without Leo Messi, but they have, you know, Busquets and Alba and Suarez. Julian Gressel's been awesome. And, Diego Gomez will likely be back from the Olympics. Federico Redondo has been really good since getting healthy again. They're integrating David Martinez in the middle of that back line. Like, they look like they're loaded up, and they look like a better version of the team that they were last year. And the team that they were last year won this tournament. I think even though there's not going to be a lot of stake in this game, I think it's the game that everybody is sort of justifiably going to want to tune into. East 4. Right now, it's the Philadelphia Union atop the standings. They won maybe the ugliest game of the tournament with their 1-0 over Charlotte back on match day one. Charlotte lost that game, then turned around and beat one of the Grandes, beat Cruz Azul on penalties. It was another kind of ugly game, but Charlotte deserves a ton of credit. David Bingham was, you know, playing for Christian Colina, who is still the undisputed starter in goal, but we've seen a lot of coaches rotate their goalkeepers. David Bingham was excellent. Even before the shootout, like, just getting Charlotte to the shootout against Cruz Azul was excellent. I still think, even though they're up against it, I still think Cruz Azul are probably favored to go through. Like, the Union have been much better over the past 2-3 weeks. But Cruz Azul are one of, I think, the favorites in this tournament, even though they are absolutely cursed. They have just gone out and added so much to a team that was already very good. And I think that, look, it would be a massive positive indicator for the Union if they're able to get a result against Cruz Azul, just as it was for Charlotte. For the Charlotte team, I had them as, the second tier, like potential contenders in this because of their ability to sort of bend but not break defensively. And the Union at their best over the past 5 years have had that as well. It went away the first half of this season. If they have it back for this game, then they can pull off the upset. And Cruz Azul going out in the group stage would be absolutely shocking, given how well they've played to start the Apertura and given the high hopes in that fan base. So in terms of star power, I don't think it matches Miami versus Tigres. Nothing does. But in terms of what's actually on the line, it's a huge one. Because if Cruz Azul lose this game, they're out. And that would be a shock. East 5, this group is wild. Because of the tie, I'm going to read you the tiebreakers before I go through East 5. The first tiebreaker is direct head-to-head match result between the tied clubs. So for clarity purposes, a win in penalty kicks is a win for purposes of this tiebreaker. The second tiebreak is better goal differential between goals scored and goals conceded over the group stage. And then the third tiebreaker is greater number of goals scored during the group stage. Fourth tiebreaker is fewer number goals conceded during the group stage. And then you get into like fair play table and all of that. So the way it shakes out in East 5 right now is the Revs are top with 3 points from one game. They had a 1-0 win over Mazatlan. Mazatlan have played their two games. They have 3 points. They beat Nashville 2-0. Nashville's only game so far has been that 2-0 loss. Mazatlan have 2 goals scored and 1 goal allowed. New England have 1 goal scored and no goals allowed. Nashville have 0 goals scored and 2 goals allowed. So if Nashville were to beat New England, all three teams would finish on 3 points. However, New England would have an even goal differential. Nashville, let's say they win 1-0, would have a -1 goal differential, and Mazatlan would still have that +1 goal differential. However, Nashville would advance over New England because they have the tiebreaker. Mazatlan, even though they don't have the tiebreaker over New England, have the tiebreaker over Nashville because of their head-to-head victory. And they have the tiebreaker because of goal differential. Therefore, Mazatlan and Nashville would go through and New England would not advance. You got that? It's confusing. And if you're a New England fan, you're really hoping that your team can take care of business against the Nashville team that has struggled. And in particular, they struggled in BJ Callahan's debut as head coach against Mazatlan with their inability. It's the same thing that we've seen all year. They had an inability to progress the ball through central midfield. Their new U22 signing, Yazbek, got on the field. And I was looking at his pass map, and it was all square. Like, he was not breaking lines at all. And then BJ Callahan paired him with Anibal Godoy, who, like Yazbek, is a number eight. And so by playing 2 8s in central midfield, they kind of sacrificed ball-winning ability for, in theory, ball progression. And in actuality, they got neither. So I think it had to have been a learning experience. And I think going into this New England game for Nashville, there needs to be some level of adjustment. I think just straight up like personnel adjustment from BJ Callahan. And for the Revs, they got their new signing across the finish line. The one that our friend Tommy Scoops had been, informing us about incessantly over the past week or so. His name is Luca Lagone. He's now the club record signing for the Revs, fee around $7 million. He's a winger. I'm not sure he'll be able to play as soon as this weekend. And Carlos Gil is still a doubt. And then obviously the big thing is they just made a massive trade in sending out DeJuan Jones to the Crew for Will Sands and a massive allocation cash. I think it's $300,000 this year and then another $300,000 next year. That's a tough one because we've seen DeJuan Jones at his very best is one of, if not the best fullback in the league. So New England go into this game as a team kind of in flux, you know, chopping and changing, sending out starters and maybe bringing new starters in. It could end up looking like a 4-3-3 instead of a 4-2-3-1, especially with Carlos Gil in doubt. It's a lot to try to take in, and obviously Nashville are a team in flux as well. We kind of raised an eyebrow at this group when we all saw it, because New England and Nashville and Mazatlan are three teams that are really on the struggle bus, and that's what we've gotten so far, especially from Nashville. So going to be an interesting game to keep an eye on. Hard to imagine any of these teams advancing much further than the round of 32, but stranger things have happened. E6, right now it's Pachuca atop the standings. They have played one game. They honestly got the brakes beat off of them at Red Bull Arena by a Red Bull team that could not put the ball in the back of the net. And Red Bull's fans are really tired of hearing that, but it was the story. They got it to penalty shootout. Pachuca did. And, they were able to get the win, I think, in the seventh round after Dylan Nealis took one of the worst penalties I've ever seen. Pachuca do not look anything like the team that that won CONCACAF Champions Cup just a couple of months ago. They are, I think, a team that maybe is going to make an addition as the Liga MX window is still open, but they were good enough. Like, they held on for dear life. They got a couple of lucky breaks, and they're through because the Red Bulls are eliminated. They made it to two penalty shootouts. They lost both. The other one was to Toronto FC, who we have not seen play since that first weekend. It'll be interesting. I keep using that word, but I'm kind of fascinated to see what John Herdman is going to do with this lineup. That, I mean, the 3-4-2-1 with Federico Bernardeschi inverted has not been great. Like, I think they have been a little bit starved of reliable ball progression from the back line into central midfield. And that has kind of unbalanced the team because Bernardeschi keeps coming inside to get on the ball. And I can't really blame him because he is the most dangerous player on this roster. So there are real question marks in terms of what kind of team Toronto is at this point. And the game against Pachuca, again, with not really much on the line, is still going to be a worthwhile data point, especially as they're still working Richie Larea and Jonathan Osorio back into the group after they were gone for so long with Canada at the Copa America. E7, DC United have already won the group. Atlanta are second with 1 point, and Santos Laguna, they've played one game. To DC, they lost it 3-0. They are bottom. That means Atlanta United, if they win either via penalty shootout, or just outright, they advance. And they honestly should against this Santos Laguna team. They are at the bottom of virtually every attacking metric there is in Liga MX so far this year. And sometimes that could be a little bit deceiving based upon how they played against DC, where they got just run off the field. I don't think it is deceiving. I think this is the worst Santos team in at least 7-8 years, or maybe even longer. You know, they had a team, got around 20 years ago, that only won one game in the league season, and it wouldn't shock me if that ended up being the story for this group as well, just based upon what we've seen from them so far. It is a significant test for this Atlanta team that has found ways all season long to disappoint. They will, I think, have Alexi Maranchuk. I think he will be available for this one this weekend. I can't say that for sure, but it's something to keep an eye on in the lead up to the game to see if he gets the paperwork done and is actually in the roster. Maranchuk, of course, the left-footed number 10 Russian international that they just purchased for about $12 or $13 million from Atalanta. His attacking numbers have been so good, both for club and country, for so long. It looks like, on paper, it looks like a very good attacking upgrade. And of course, we're still waiting for them to add a DP center forward as well. Though in the meantime, Daniel Rios has been awesome. He's been really, really good for them since returning to MLS. And he was supposed to just be the backup, but he might have the job for a little bit based upon how well he's playing. Okay, out west, I think the biggest shock of this tournament so far is that Austin are through. 6 points through two games against two of the giants in Pumas, who have been excellent to start this Apertura, and Monterrey, who are consistently among the absolute giants. The Pumas game, Austin took a lead, gave it up, went down to 10 men, still scored two more goals, conceded, I think, 25 shots, were outshot 25-6. And it was just one of those wins that in no way feels repeatable. And they went out 3 days later against Monterrey and repeated it almost exactly, with the only difference being they didn't go down a goal and they didn't go down to 10 men. But like, if you watched that Monterrey game, it was just an exercise in holding on for dear life from Austin and then hitting opportunistically on set pieces or on the break. And credit to them for, I think, having the mental fortitude and togetherness to sort of weather that storm and hold out against a Monterrey team that has made a habit over the past 15 years of embarrassing MLS teams. Like, this is Monterrey, and I know they have a reputation in league play for disappointing pretty much always in the Liguilla semifinals, but in, you know, international play, continental play, they've been the best team in North America over the past 15 years. They have owned CONCACAF Champions League. And of course, they were the most successful team in Leagues Cup last year. They're the ones who made it to the semifinals before being eliminated. And of course, they lost that third place game to Philadelphia when it was a case of the walking dead. Monterrey didn't have anything to play for. Philly did. And that game showed it. But still, they made it further than any of the other Liga MX teams. They have that pedigree, and Austin, to their credit, just weathered the storm and were able to hit on the break. I think Owen Wolf has the assist of the tournament so far when he was able to dribble into traffic in central midfield, literally surrounded by four players, somehow turn out of it with the ball on his feet and then play an inch-perfect through ball to Danny Pereira, who did a really good job of staying onside, and that was the icer. That's the one that made it 2-0. We've also seen a couple of debuts from Osman Bukhari and Sebastian Dressler, the right back, I thought, who was very, very good. But Austin are through, and so Pumas and Monterrey go into this final game where it's winner take all. Like that is these two teams in the final group stage game for West 1, whoever wins goes through, whether it's outright or via penalties. Whoever loses goes home and probably has some harsh assessments to do. Okay, West 2. LA Galaxy are currently top with 3 points from one game. That's a win over San Jose. Those Quakes are in second place with 2 points through two games, and Chivas are third with 1 point through two games. If the Galaxy win outright or in penalties, the Galaxy go through regardless. San Jose go through. So if you're a San Jose Earthquakes fan, you hold your nose and you root for the LA Galaxy. Chivas, I don't think were particularly good in that first game against the Quakes until the final 10 or 15 minutes when they kind of threw the kitchen sink in and it became the tactics free zone. And I thought the Quakes made a mistake in dropping their line so deep. We talked about this, Weeby and I did, on Monday's show. The Galaxy midweek, I thought, were very good against San Jose. They just were not able to be clinical with their chances in the box. Not until the very end when Ricky Pooch, he found Mickey Yamani on an overlap that just caught poor Benji Kakanovic completely flat-footed and squared it across the six for Miguel Berry. It's the type of goal you draw up when you have a player like Ricky Pooch pulling the strings in central midfield. But no Marco Royce yet, and Dejan Jovetic still injured. So it's going to be Joseph Paintsil up top, most likely as a number nine, with Diego Fagundes on one side and Gabriel Peck on the other for the Galaxy. I'm actually good with that in this game because I think Chivas are going to come out and they're going to come upfield a little bit. I think Chivas are going to try to have the ball in this game. And when that happens, Paintsil and Peck both are kind of incredible at finding space behind the opposing back line. And if you have a through ball artist like Ricky and two attackers who find space behind the opposing back line, you're probably well advised to just drop your line a little bit and let the other the opponents be the protagonists with the ball and hit him in space. So I like this matchup for LA. Of note, Jalen Neal was, I thought, very good. 20-year-old homegrown center back. He was very good against San Jose. It's nice to see him sort of return to full health. He's missed almost a year, and his comeback this year has been sort of in fits and starts. But he looked himself in this one, and he's a really high-level young center back. And it's really good to see the Galaxy developing some of their homegrown players, because we all know what a hotbed Southern California is. The Quakes would be well advised to sort of follow that lead. Of course, one of the best Quakes potential homegrowns will likely be playing for Chivas in this one. And no, I'm not talking about Cade Cowell. I'm talking about Fidel Barajas. He's from Northern California, and he was, of course, in the Quakes Academy for a hot minute, but they weren't able to keep him and develop him. It's something that they have to work on as a club. They have to make it a priority to keep and develop their best young players. The other big surprise is that in West 3, Dallas are already eliminated. They took a really bad 2-0 loss to Juarez at home after losing 2-1 on the road to St. Louis, which I think was, you know, a road loss in that situation. Totally understandable. A home loss to a team like Juarez, which have not been very good at all in the Apertura. That is kind of devastating for Dallas. Excused a little bit by the fact that they still have so many injuries and absences. No Jesus Ferreira, no Alan Velasco, no Asier Iaramendi. It's a lot. And Peter Luxon has, I think, done well with it. But this was a team that, look, Ferreira, Velasco, and Yarramendi are their three most creative players. And this was a team that looked like they were, it was missing its three most creative players in this one. So they're out. St. Louis are still in it. They are going to advance. Hartle, Teutscher, Simon Betcher. Right, we've talked about Hartle and Teutscher, who play as sort of a attacking left midfielder and a second forward or playmaker, depending on whether you want to call it a 4-4-1-1 or a 4-2-3-1. These guys who have good second Bundesliga pedigrees have looked the part since they came in. Simon Betcher, he was really good against FC Dallas. Like he was someone who I was impressed with for Vancouver last year when he got, you know, brief runouts as Brian White's backup. And of course, then he went to Denmark for a half a season. That didn't work out. Now he's back. This could end up being an under the radar signing for St. Louis City, who haven't gotten the same level of either productivity or chemistry generation from their center forwards this year. And by chemistry generation, I mean the type of thing where the center forward is making the types of runs that sort of pull center backs, plural, into his gravity. That open up spaces for your playmakers. We haven't seen a lot of that from Klaus, and I thought Sam Adeniran did a good job of that, but obviously he's gone now, and he was playing only sporadically before he was traded. Nico Gioacchini, I thought, did a good job of that last year, and obviously he was sold, and I don't think it was wrong to sell him. But Betcher sort of does that naturally. I don't think he's ever going to be a high-level goal scorer. You know, this is not a guy who's going to score, you know, 15, 18 goals in a season. But given the additions and also the sort of knock-on effect of Hartle and Teutscher pushing Edward Leuven back a level to play as a number eight, which I think is pretty clearly his best spot, Betcher just being on the field makes St. Louis sort of more dangerous holistically in a way that I didn't really account for. It's a one game takeaway, so it can end up being completely wrong, but it makes them, I think, one of the most important teams to watch this weekend. I want to see if they can inflict the same type of damage on Juarez as they did on Dallas, because even though, you know, St. Louis still gave up a ton of chances against Dallas and Roman Berkey had to be a superstar, they were more complete going forward in that game than they've looked basically all season long. And they were able to do it in a way that was more about using the ball than I think we've seen from St. Louis. And that's a change from the Bradley Carnell era to the John Hackworth era. John Hackworth is a good coach who's been around a long time. He's not an energy drink soccer coach, right? He wants his team. He's always wanted his team to have the ball. And now maybe that's what we'll see. That's another knock-on effect of dropping Leuven down a level to being a number eight, where he can be more about distribution and ball progression rather than chance creation. He's a decent chance creator. He's not a high level chance creator. He is a very high level ball progressor. So it kind of has a chance to come together very quickly for this St. Louis team that looks in the league, they look dead in the water. But maybe that changes. Maybe they're able to put together a good little run here and then spin that into a charge up the standings during the stretch run. West 4, for a hot minute midweek, it looked like Chicago were going to pull off the upset and send Toluca packing. But no, that's not how it worked out. The Fire took a 1-0 lead Toluca stayed calm and they answered back with three goals of their own. It is a 3-1 win for the Red Devils, which eliminates Chicago, which means that Toluca and Sporting KC are through. Sporting KC, of course, beat the Fire 2-1 back in the first round of group stage games. Massive test for Sporting KC because Toluca have looked like one of the best teams in the Apertura this year. They obviously spent a ton of money in the transfer window. And then once they got the first half hour out of their legs, they were so much better than Chicago. I think Toluca are a team that could very well win this tournament. So this is a massive test for a Sporting Kansas City team that we've seen sort of toggle between a 4-3-3 and a 4-2-3-1 over the past 6-8 weeks. And we've also seen Peter Vermes start to turn the page. Willy Agata, I think, is the starter now at the number 9, and he's earned it. He had a goal against Chicago, and I think he's up to 11 goals now across all competitions this season. Steven Afrifa is starting to get more minutes and might be on the verge of winning one of the winger spots. There's less turnover along the back line, but we're still getting to see more young players. And it was necessary, right? The time had come. And so credit to Vermes for being willing to finally move on from a lot of the veterans who have been the backbone of this team for so long. And of course, were the backbone of the team that made that good run in the second half of last season and then into the playoffs. West 5, Portland, 2 wins from 2 games. 6 points. They are through. Colorado got blown out on Thursday night, 4-0. The other win for Portland was 2-1 against a Club Leon team that are in the midst of something of an overhaul. They bid farewell to Angel Mena, who is arguably the I'm not going to say the best, maybe a top three player in the club's history. They brought in Jandre Cadiz, the former Nashville SC DP, as their center forward. He's been very good to start the Apertura, and I think he had a goal for them in that loss to Portland. The Rapids just got run off the field. It was maybe the worst overall performance from Colorado that they've had this season, and obviously, that's worrying when they go into a game with everything on the line. If Colorado win via penalty shootout or, in regulation, they advance. If they do not win, they go home. And this is a team that very badly wants to win. They want to start stacking high-level, important games because that's what they're going to be playing in the playoffs. And this group collectively does not have a lot of experience in those games. Almost none, really. So this is an important game for the Colorado Rapids. I think we'll get a read on, to a degree, their mental fortitude, because they were embarrassed in Portland. Like, they were absolutely embarrassed by a Timbers team that was not at full strength. And I think that's got to stick in Chris Armas's craw a little bit, and probably the players as well. So it's a win or go home scenario for both Club Leon and the Rapids. West 6. Right now, the Seattle Sounders are on top of the standings with 3 points. Minnesota also have 3 points with a win over Necaxa, a 1-0 win in which Dane St. Clair set a League's Cup record with 16 saves, including a couple that were truly spectacular. And then Necaxa are third with no points in their one game. This is one of those with the tiebreaker scenarios coming into play. Seattle have a +2 goal differential, the tiebreaker over Minnesota. Minnesota have a -1 goal differential, the tiebreaker over Necaxa. It is all up in the air. The Sounders, we're still getting to know them in terms of what the full-strength team looks like. They were able to put Pedro de la Vega onto the field with Albert Rusnak and most of the rest of the first choice starters in that game against Minnesota United, and he was okay playing as an attacking left winger. He wasn't great. He was just okay. Paul Rothrock comes in for the final half hour. Paul Rothrock was great. And it's almost like a meme at this point among the Sounders fans that he's just an energy guy. But he keeps showing that he is so much more than just an energy guy, whether they're playing him left wing or right wing. Like, he nutmegged one of the Minnesota defenders. He, you know, he set up one goal with an inch perfect cross after a perfectly timed run. He scored another. His combination play in and around the box with guys like Jordan Morris and Albert Rusnak and Christian Roldan is really, I think it's pretty high level. He's become a perfect complementary piece. He's giving Brian Schmetzer good problems to solve. I still think De La Vega needs to be an elite attacker for Seattle to be an elite serious threat to win this tournament. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Rothrock can be that guy. It would be a hell of a story. It would be very Seattle Sounders if indeed he was. Anders wants me to note that Eva Longoria, who is partial owner of Necaxa, will be at this game. Necaxa played very well against Minnesota. They're a very young team. They were not able to turn their possession dominance into goals. And, you know, hat tip to Dane St. Clair for that one, because he truly was awesome. And then West 7, LAFC with 4 points through two games. They're already through. Vancouver with 2 points through one game. And Tijuana, of course, got buried by LAFC in the opener as Juan Carlos Osorio rotated his squad. The final game is Vancouver hosting Club Tijuana. This is a massive opportunity for the Caps to get through, to collect a decently high level win against this Tijuana team, and to get through into the round of 32. I still think that they are missing a piece. I still think that, and we saw it against LAFC, right? Like, they took a 2-0 lead. They caught LAFC napping a little bit and punished them, did a good job of that. And then obviously Seth Berhalter scores an absolute banger from a mile out. But the, you know, when LAFC put the hammer down in the second half, it was just a case of holding on for dear life for Vancouver. And you can't do that game after game after game against the best teams in the region. They still lack that extra little bit of quality. I had hoped that Pedro Vite would become that guy, develop into a high-level number 10, but he's really not. He's more of just a pass connector rather than a chance creator. And so it all does come down to Brian White, Ryan Gauld, and now Fafa Picot, and those are three very good attackers. Gauld, you know, maybe even better than that, but they're not the type of trident that the best teams in this region have. So more proof for them, more another test in this game, another chance to prove that assessment of mine incorrect. We shall see. I like their chances of going through. I don't love their chances of making a deep run just because of that lack of top-end quality. And then the final group, West 8. As of now, both RSL and Atlas are on 3 points. Atlas have played their two games. They got a really good win at Houston, 1-0. And then they lost last night 2-1. to RSL after Nelson Palacio hit. I mean, apologies to Berhalter, but the banger of the tournament. Just an absolute scorcher from Palacio. I thought that RSL were the better team throughout. And I thought that, you know, Andres Gomez, he has leveled up. Emeka Anelli has leveled up as well. And now they get Chicho Arango back, which is a huge bonus for this team. If he can be the guy he was for the first 4 months of the season, then RSL have the chance to make a run and maybe even win this thing. The flip side is that Houston might have that chance as well. It's got to be frustrating for them to have lost that game to Atlas. I thought Houston were the better team. Ezequiel Ponce has made his debut. He started two games now. He hasn't been particularly effective in either. I am wondering if maybe Ben Olsen goes back to Sebas Ferreira in this game, because Houston, they need to win outright. They need to beat RSL outright in order to advance. And if they do that, then it does come down to the tiebreakers. And it could get pretty crazy in that one, because a 1-0 win for Houston leaves all three teams on an even goal differential. And I'll let the mathematicians figure out who goes through at that point. Make sure you catch MLS Countdown before that game, because they will take you through all the scenarios for that one. And I've just taken you through all 15 groups in this one. Of course, I haven't mentioned Club America or Columbus Crew very much, and that's because they have a bye into the round of 32. We will see those two teams and 30 others After this weekend, we will have the entire round of 32 set. I'm looking forward to catching all of that. And of course, on Monday's Extra Time, we will have a guide to all of that, hopefully with Weeby back. In the meantime, we're going to bring in our friend Rodolfo Landeros. You know him, you love him from MLS Season Pass. He has been all over North America, really the past 15 years or so, calling games in MLS and Liga MX and CONCACAF Champions League and now Leagues Cup. How you doing, bud?
Well, now I sound old, man, but thank you very much. No, I'm good. It's good. Great to be here. It's always exciting when these two leagues collide. It's sort of like a marriage, and then it's not like they want to go into a divorce, but there's always a struggle, you know. But right now MLS is having the upper hand once again.
Yeah, second year in a row, MLS is coming out on top so far. The record is 11-4 MLS in the 15 games that have been played between the two sides. There's one PK win for Liga MX teams. That was Pachuca over the Red Bulls. And then three PK wins for the MLS teams. But let's start by talking about one of the big games this weekend, Pumas versus Monterrey. Pumas, of course, one of the grandes, old money in certain terms in Mexico. They've been around forever, one of the big teams forever. Monterrey, kind of new money in that regard. Two of the bigger Liga MX teams, and two teams who are on a collision course. The winner advances, the loser goes home. Tell me what you've seen from these two so far and what you're expecting from this game on Saturday.
Well, it's been quite troubling to see a team like Monterrey struggle with Austin. I was there at Q2 Stadium calling the game between Rayados and the Verde and Black, and I expected a lot more from a team like Monterrey, because they're one of the big spenders since probably the last 10 years. They've come up short in titles, and they started well this tournament, and we thought, me and my colleagues, we thought that would, you know, transcend into Leagues Cup. And the way they played against Austin, it was like they had 75% possession, but it's not how much time or how much do you have the ball, it's what you do with it. And I saw Brad Stuber practically you know, sweatless during the whole match. He wasn't in sort of a predicament of sorts. And you have quality like Berterame and obviously guys like Maxi Mesa who came from the bench. And Austin were, they pulled off a great job, credit to them. But you expect more from a team like Rayados. I think it was Peter Vermees who once called this or it was Jim Curtin, pardon me. This is a team that has over 11 designated players. And mm-hmm. if you have a team like that stacked, even in the bench, you have to show it in the field. And now they're in a tight spot playing against Pumas, who also did pretty well in the start of this season. They're a team that's called one of the grandes because of popularity, and they had a great run in the 80s and 90s. But the thing is, they haven't won a title since 2011, and they never were the big spenders up until now. They open up the checkbook. They need to show up from the front office, as opposed to a team like Monterrey, who's been, you know, spending and spending. Now they brought Oliver Torres. They had to spend a lot on Sergio Canales from Real Betis Balompié. And the thing with Pumas is, if we're not there at the same level as Club America, Tigres, and Monterrey, we're going to fall up short, because the fan base is eager for some titles. And one of the things I think about these Mexican teams in League's Cup is I think they're wasting an excellent opportunity to build their fan base even more, even bigger. Because when you think about teams like Pumas, Chivas, America, Cruz Azul, they're one of the most popular teams in North America. But when it comes to, for example, Monterrey, it's very regional, you know? And mm-hmm. this is a possibility to tap into these markets and build your fan base. So I think probably America and Tigres is trying to do that, you know? How do you get more fans involved? How do you get all the fans across the border? And one of the things is obviously doing certain activities around these games, but also you have to show it in the field, because how do you want to win more fans? By winning. And Monterrey is in a tight spot right now. It's going to be a great match between both. Obviously, the one of the big stories is Rogelio Funes Mori, one of the best players in recent history for Monterrey, now playing for Pumas. We'll see how he holds up.
It'll be interesting to see that one play out, as you mentioned, Funes Mori. But Pumas have actually turned a little bit towards their academy, towards building from within, which is not something that I think was comfortable for them 10 years ago. But they seem to have invested, because they can't keep up on the open market with the likes of Club America and Rayados and Tigres. And it's going to take patience for it to pay off. But I think it's a smart overall strategy for them. A couple other grandes have played already, Cruz Azul and Chivas, and they've also struggled. Where is this coming from, this level of struggle? And like, are the fan bases sort of reacting at this in the moment, or will there be a front office reaction to it, like changes to the squad, or like are managerial jobs on the line here if these teams do not perform in this tournament?
There is pressure, without a doubt. And we saw that last year. Cruz Azul spent a lot of money on bringing Tuca Ferretti, one of the most decorated coaches in Liga MX, with Tigres winning 5 titles in a decade. And they got Tuca Ferretti, and when they got eliminated in the group stage, and that it all started with that Inter Miami with Lionel Messi and his presentation card with MLS fans, they sacked Tuca Ferretti. So when you think about teams like, for example, Monterrey, it wasn't the brightest start for them, because they got beat in league with a 4-0 against Cruz Azul. And if you ask me which job is walking on thin ice, I would think Dan Ortiz is one of them. If they don't beat Pumas, the fans, media, they're going to be all over the place. And obviously, what I saw that night, I thought they were too probably extra confident. Like, okay, we got this. Let's move the ball around. And when Austin got the first goal, it was like, oh man, I think we need to step up. And then they found this beautiful play with Owen Wolf sending Danny Pereira up front and beating Esteban Andrade, and they couldn't react to that. And I think that's when you take a look at, for example, from a fan perspective, mostly in Mexico, I don't care about this tournament. But then if they don't get a result, they're like, this guy should get fired. Then, okay, now I think it really matters, because if you're saying that it doesn't matter and then a coach should get sacked because of not getting results in Leagues Cup, then obviously there's something there. But I think Dan Ortiz's job, without a doubt, is on the line for sure.
Yeah, we've seen some mental fragility from, I think, Monterrey in big moments in the past. But obviously, that's Cruz Azul as well. If you think about 30 years ago, Cruz Azul were right there neck and neck with Club America as, you know, the most successful team in North America. And they've gone sort of wildly divergent paths in the past quarter century or so. There's a lot of hope in that fan base for this current team with the way they went out and spent. Good start in the Apertura, bad start in the League's Cup. Is the pressure going to mount already, or is this something that the fans, the front office, will be able to look at and say, look, sometimes there are going to be bumps in the road. What we have to do is be willing to live with that and stay the course and build something that is sustainable.
Yeah, well, I think from a personal perspective, I think Cruz Azul is, with Pachuca, the best teams that are playing football right now in Liga MX, and they're cruising right now in league. And it was really surprising that they didn't get the result against Charlotte. Obviously, also credit to David Bingham. He was a stud out there. But now with they were missing a couple of pieces. One of them was a killer in the box. And I think with Yorgos Giakoumakis, I mean, you've seen him every single week with Atlanta United. He was one of the big guys. And I thought with his inclusion in the roster, Cruz Azul's chances are of winning everything, even Leagues Cup and the Apertura title. I don't think there's going to be a lot of pressure if they don't get out of the group stage. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of frustration because this is a team that since 97, they were practically winless up until 2021, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And there were 23 years, and that was probably a whole generation that were speaking to their parents like, why should I care about this team? They never win. they're always showing up in finals, and they never win it. And this came to a made-up verb called Cruz Azulear, where it's basically you had the chance, and in the final moment, the more critical chance, you failed miserably. And I think that has been evaporating in the last seasons. I think Anselmi, who's the coach, has shown beautiful football. A lot of teams struggle playing against Cruz Azul, and Charlotte was a team that obviously studied, did their homework, and I think now Cruz Azul will fight up against one of my personal favorite teams in MLS, which is Philadelphia. They're not doing so well, obviously, in MLS in terms of league, but I think it's not going to be easy for them because, I mean, we know Jim Curtin, he's comfortable not having the ball. He will be missing Juli, but I think they got a chance of eliminating La Máquina.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll be looking at the film from Charlotte's win over La Máquina and hoping that Andre Blake can have as good a game as David Bingham did in net for the crown. The other grande that we briefly mentioned that we should really talk about a little bit is Chivas. This is a team that 7-8 years ago under Matias Almeida had honestly their best run of the past half century, right? They won one league. They won a CONCACAF Champions League. I think they won a couple of Copa MX and I think a Super Copa as well. That's a good run for anybody. They have not been able to follow that up with anything consistent in terms of getting results. They have actually changed their philosophy in terms of what types of players they're allowing themselves to bring into their club. For the longest time, it was Mexican only. And then it was, I think Zinia was the first naturalized Mexican who played for Chivas.
He didn't play for Chivas, but there were certain, I mean, it's not like a rule book, like an internal rule book, but then they switched because it was like a statement they made, like, we only play with Mexicans. But then it was like, okay, Mexican from birth, which means if your father or mother was born in Mexico and you were born in Myanmar, or if you're born in Philippines, you are able to play. This was the case, for example, with Kate Cowell, who has Mexican roots, even though he wasn't born. Or, for example, Santiago Ormeño, born in Mexico City of Peruvian parents. He was eligible to play for the Peruvian national team. He played for Peru, and he gained a lot of controversy among Chivas fans and obviously Chivas rivals, who's the Americanistas. And they say, now you're signing whoever you want to sign because you can't win with what you got. And the truth of the matter is, Chivas playing with only Mexican-born or Mexican parents, they struggle real, because they sell these Mexican players higher than they usually, because they know the need that Chivas wants to fight for titles, and they know that they can sell to Chivas in a higher price. So that's the deficit that the Chivas carries. I honestly think that if they can play with naturalized players, they'll be very closer to success. And that season you mentioned with Pelado Almeida, that was a time where they spent big money on Rodolfo Pizarro, on guys like Rodolfo Cota on goal, Osvaldo Alaniz. They had like a backbone that was really, really solid, but they couldn't sustain that. They had to sell every single player of that backbone, and now they're trying to rebuild that. They brought in Chicharito, and that first season in the last Clausura was tough because he was recovering from a serious injury. This is the time now that Chicharito has to step up, and he will be judged. And what a big game he has against LA Galaxy, his former team in Major League Soccer. I'm sure that fans are expecting that. I don't think he left in the best way possible, injury-wise. And this is a guy that's a natural-born competitor. He will fight. He bleeds the Chivas blood. And if he starts, which I think he will, this will be the game that most matters to him in the immediate sense.
Yeah, and advancement into the round of 32 is on the line here. If Chivas lose, then it's actually San Jose who will advance. So they need to go and beat the Galaxy, be it by penalty shootout or outright. So there's a lot of pressure on them. Cade Cowell, another guy on that team. Fidel Barajas, Mexican-American from the San Jose area. Chivas still have that policy, and they're being a little bit more flexible with it. And I think the hope for a lot of their fans is that by incorporating more Mexican Americans, not only can they start winning, maybe a few more titles, but actually grow that fan base, which, to be fair, is already huge. But they are starved for some silverware. All of this that we're talking about is within the context of sort of the state of play in Liga MX having changed over the past 15 years. It's become more top heavy. Club America are still dominant. Of the Grandes, so the traditional teams, they're the ones that have weathered it the best. But then we're seeing Tigres and Monterrey, which are still, as you said, sort of regional fan bases and regional teams. In terms of league titles over the past 15 years, it is Tigres who are number one. In terms of continental titles, it is Monterrey who are number one. And these are the three teams, Club America, Tigres, Monterrey, who have been able to spend the most money. Is it that simple, the biggest pocketbook, or are there other things that these teams are doing that's leading to success?
I think it's a combination of both, having a project and having big bucks. It hasn't worked for Monterrey because they've been switching managers and they've been spending a lot of money. And ever since it was Diego Alonso who won that CONCACAF Champions mm-hmm. League, which then led him to coach Inter Miami. And it was Javier Aguirre, the new, once again, Mexican national team coach, coached the Club World Cup. It was a major failure. They didn't win the first game, and that led to Javier Aguirre being sacked. But they've been switching around coaches, and it hasn't worked for them. Club America spends wisely. They don't spend as much as Tigres and Monterrey, but I think they have a solid project. Now that with Andres Jardine winning back-to-back championships, they failed for CONCACAF Champions Cup, which is one of the things that I would think they were desperate to win. It wasn't the case. And as for Tigres, I mean, they've been the team of the decade. They were also the team that, for the very first time, for a CONCACAF team, played a final in the Club World Cup. They lost eventually to Bayern Munich, but it was quite an accomplishment. And now the next step for America is to win a three-peat. Nobody has ever done it in Liga MX, and obviously they want to stamp a spot on the next CONCACAF Champions Cup. This could be the key for most of these teams, and they've got a great chance. Monterrey, I think, has the most pressure. America will play a couple of friendlies right now with Chelsea and Aston Villa, and then will make their debut in the round of 32. And I think Tigres is one of those teams that, if they can shake away, because there's a scandal right now with the former manager that, I mean, I can't go into all the details because it's like a telenovela, my man. they accused the former manager of selling the inside information to their rivals, Monterrey, and now they're going to be going into a legal battle. And other than that, if they can block out that noise, because there's a lot of people involved in that situation, if they can block that out, I think they've got a good chance. I expected this to be a different League's Cup in terms of having Mexican teams in the final. When we initially did, we had some picks with Tony Kerky and Mariano Trujillo in the studios in New York. I said it was going to be Tigres and America. Right now, it's like, I mean, these Mexican teams, they're not stepping up. If there's a team that can do it, I think it's America, but we'll have to wait and see because they haven't played anybody yet.
Before we get into the knockout rounds, let me just ask you, big picture, is there a sense that sort of the mid-table teams like Toluca, Club León, Pachuca have the resources to keep up with the biggest teams? I mean, we've seen over the past 3 years, it seems like Santos Laguna, who had a great 15-year run, but it seems like they've fallen off a cliff. Do we think this is going to end up with more Liga MX teams trying to develop from within? Or like, what is the solution here to sort of restore the balance that was kind of a hallmark of the league throughout the 2000s?
Yeah, well, Toluca is a good example. They haven't been the biggest spenders, even though they won 7 championships in a nice streak. They haven't won a league title since 2010, but now they spent a lot of money bringing defender Luan Garcia from Palmeiras, now Paulinho from a Sporting Club in Portugal. This has never been the case that they spent over 80 million bucks for a player. And they have a chance to sell Maxi Araujo, who played for Uruguay in Copa America. They were asking for 20 million for him, 23 million for him. So this could be a good chance to even go and sign even more players that can fit into Paiva's squad. I think Toluca have a good chance. They beat Chicago recently. When you take Chicago into parameter, this is a team that has struggled over the last years in Major League Soccer. So I would take it like not to be disrespectful for Chicago, but I wouldn't be overconfident on Toluca. And this is my team, so I don't want to bring in the bells and whistles for Los Diablos. And for León, I wouldn't put my chips in León. This is a team that hasn't done well recently. They have a new manager with Jorge Baba. They're still struggling to find like their stride. I don't know if they lost confidence in the bench, but I'm not satisfied from what I've seen in Leon and based on what we saw from them in recent years with Larcamón and Gustavo Matosas, who won back-to-back championships with them. They're not there. And as for the rest of the teams, I mean, when you take a look at Pachuca, they've done well. Right now they're sitting in the middle of the table, but they won a Champions Cup. I think they can step up. They play beautiful football. Having this experience in youth, a lot of players from the academy, and mm-hmm. having Salomón Rondón, Idrissi, who was in, they were both in MLS All-Star Week. I think they can turn the table from that that probably hiccup they had in the start of Leagues Cup. Other than that, I mean, I was really surprised that Mazatlán and Juárez won. Just like last year, they went through the group stage being one of the modest teams in Liga MX. I don't think they will reach further stages, but this is what I mentioned. This is your chance that you can turn the tide of battle from a league perspective, and also an opportunity to tap into different markets. If they are able to seize that, then you could call your League's Cup performance a success. If not, they're going to be still struggling. And since you don't have, obviously, relegation, from what I've seen from a lot of players and reacting to not having pro rel, they're like, well, you relax, and that's what I don't like. If you don't have any motivation to be playing in first division soccer, and if you're telling me that, it's like, what are you doing? So I think if they can take a shot in League's Cup and show what this could even signify. Okay, this player is interesting. Maybe I can, you know, if you're an MLS club, I can brew some interest in this player and bring him to my side. If you're one of these modest teams from Liga MX, and, you know, structure-wise, lifestyle-wise, other than Mazatlán and Juárez, I think it should be a better opportunity.
That is the hope for a lot of these teams and a lot of these players. Obviously, there's a trophy on the line in Leagues Cup. There could be a lot more in terms of what it means for these guys' careers. Rodolfo, we appreciate you joining us. What game are you on this weekend?
I'm going to be on the Houston Dynamo RSL, which I can't wait. I've been very impressed with Pablo Mastroianni's team, and should be a good one. That's going to be on Monday. I'll be traveling to Houston on Sunday.
Right. So long weekend of games. I think the final game of the group stage is on Tuesday. So it's wall to wall starting up on Saturday. We'll be sure to catch you on MLS Season Pass. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you to our listeners for sticking around for this one. Always a pleasure to talk to you all. Leagues Cup all weekend long on MLS Season Pass. You know how to tune in. We'll see you there. And we'll see you again on Extra Time next week. Take care.